Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. UN accuses Syria of massive extermination and of crimes against humanity. Massive extermination of detainees. That's what the United Nations investigators accuse Syria of carrying out today, alleging that it amounts to a crime against humanity. The UN investigation said the government of President Bashar al-Assad is holding tens of thousands of detainees from its civilian population at any one time, and that thousands more have disappeared after their arrests or gone missing after being abducted by armed groups. In the meantime, more than 25,000 Syrian civilians have become the unwitting victims of a standoff between Turkey and Western relief agencies. The Turkish government refuses to admit the refugees, the first in a wave of civilians fleeing an offensive by the regime of President Bashar al-Assad in the northern Aleppo countryside. Turkish officials say their country has reached the limit on the number of Syrian refugees it can admit. In a bid to pressure the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, United Nations and Western relief agencies are refusing to dispatch aid across the border to the refugees. And in a story not unrelated, at least 35 migrants drowned in the Aegean Sea today, trying to reach Greece from Turkey. Turkey's Coast Guard rescued seven people as two boats sank in separate accidents off the Turkish coast. Both vessels were en route to the Greek island of Lesbos, according to the Turkish media. The latest fatalities drive the death toll for Mediterranean crossings to nearly 400 since the beginning of 2016. Somali security officials say the explosion last week aboard a Dalo Airlines Airbus that had to make an emergency landing in Mogadishu was caused by a bomb. Security footage at the airport shows two men, one apparently an airport employee, handing what appears to be a computer to the suspected suicide bomber. This is VOA News. A Taliban suicide bomber on Monday killed at least three Afghan soldiers and wounded more than 18 others in the northern Balkh province. Afghan officials, citing initial reports from the scene, say a bus carrying personnel of the Afghan National Army was the target of the attack. Eyewitnesses told local reporters they saw at least eight dead among the victims. A Taliban official requesting anonymity told VOA that the only solution to end the war was for the foreign forces to withdraw from the country. But the commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, General John Campbell, insisted there are no preconditions when it comes to talking about the peace process.
They got to honor the Afghan Constitution. They got to honor women's rights. They got to lay down their arms. They got to stop their terrorist acts. Once they do that, then we can get to the table.
He told reporters in Kabul on Sunday that Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah have both already explained the way forward for peace talks with the Taliban. U.S. President Obama is asking Congress for more than $1.8 billion in emergency funding to help fight the Zika virus in the United States and other countries. In a statement on Monday, the White House says the funding would support essential strategies to combat the virus, such as rapidly expanding mosquito control programs, accelerating vaccine research and diagnostic development, and providing health care services and support for low-income pregnant women. A new poll suggests Vermont Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders and Republican businessman Donald Trump are maintaining their large leads in the U.S. state of New Hampshire, which holds a presidential primary vote tomorrow. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone is in New Hampshire.
Hillary Clinton is trying to regain some ground here. She trails in New Hampshire by a fair bit. They're hoping they can narrow the gap between now and Tuesday, primary day. But Clinton also has a longer strategy. And even though we expect this debate between the two of them to go on as to who is more progressive, Clinton can look to states like Nevada with its large Hispanic population and South Carolina later in the month with its sizable African-American community. Clinton believes, their campaign believes, they have a firewall with minority voters. And so far, from what we can tell, that's been a challenge for Bernie Sanders to break beyond sort of white progressives and draw in some minority voters.
VOA's Jim Malone in Manchester, New Hampshire. Haiti's president has stepped down from office. Michel Martelly left office Sunday as required by Haiti's constitution. Prime Minister Evans Paul is Haiti's temporary leader until a provisional president is chosen by parliament in the next few days. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hees Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
There have been continuing calls from his supporters for Paul Biya, the 83-year-old president of Cameroon, who has been in power for more than three decades, to stand again as candidate for president. The calls, which opposition parties are strongly condemning, are also asking Biya to call early presidential elections.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting. Details coming up.
Also, it's estimated 4.7 million people, or about 40% of the Somali population, are in need of humanitarian assistance, and tens of thousands of civilians have been displaced by fighting in Sudan's Darfur region.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burkina Faso, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, UN humanitarian officials described the food security and malnutrition situation in Somalia as alarming. They say it's especially bad in parts of Puntland and Somaliland, which have been hard hit by drought. It's estimated 4.7 million people, or about 40% of the Somali population, are in need of humanitarian assistance. Nearly 1 million of those are reported to be acutely food insecure. Officials say that means they must struggle each day to find enough to eat. Displaced people make up most of those acutely food insecure. But Somalia is not alone, with many people facing hunger. UN agencies say 2.8 million people in South Sudan, nearly 25% of the population, are in urgent need of food aid. They say about 40,000 people are on what they call the brink of catastrophe. Conflict has made the situation worse. For example, in Unity State, many people have been living on fish and water lilies. Livestock raids have made food even harder to get. Also, some 200,000 people in northern Bahr el Ghazal and Warrap states have been seeing food prices soar as access to food has decreased. The higher hunger-related figures in South Sudan come despite the recent harvest season. However, the lean dry season begins soon. The Food and Agriculture Organization, UNICEF, and the World Food Program call on all parties in South Sudan to fully implement the peace agreement.
Tens of thousands of civilians have been displaced by fighting in the Jabal Mara area of Sudan's Darfur region. The UN says weeks of clashes between government forces and rebels have created dire humanitarian circumstances. Jabal Mara straddles the north, south, and central Darfur states. UN officials say nearly 40,000 people from North Darfur have fled the fighting. Most are reported going to a camp for the displaced in North Darfur called Tawila. Others are seeking refuge in villages. Also, unconfirmed reports say as many as 50,000 people may be displaced in central Darfur state. Humanitarian agencies say the numbers of displaced may be higher, but they're not able to access the area to verify the figures. Jabal Mara is a stronghold of the rebel group known as Salawa. It's one of the groups that began fighting in Khartoum government with the Khartoum government 13 years ago.
The deputy chairman of the African Union Commission says the Commission did not abandon the people of Burundi at last week's AU summit by not sending peacekeepers to the country. Erastus Mwencha says African leaders discussed Burundi in detail and decided to first give the dialogue process a chance before sending the peacekeepers. Mwencha says leaders want to set up a high-level delegation of African leaders to travel to Burundi and meet with officials about sending peacekeeping troops. The exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, Forbu, has accused the African Union and the international community of turning their backs on the people of Burundi. Violence began in April when President Nkurunziza said he wanted a third term in office. Critics said that violated the Constitution and the Arusha Peace Accords. Since then, hundreds have been killed and about 250,000 have fled the country.
Killings have continued in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, despite security forces carrying out disarmament operations since late last year. At least 10 people were killed since Friday, including one man who was found beheaded. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
In early November, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza gave a five-day ultimatum for civilians who illegally possess weapons to hand them over to the security forces or else face 2 to 10 years in jail and a fine of $2,500. At the end of five-day period, forced disarmament operations were conducted by security forces who revealed hundreds of weapons confiscated from civilians, mostly in the Burundi capital. However, targeted killings have continued to rock the capital, regardless the government efforts to restore stability in a relatively calm capital since last month. A local club in Bujumbura suburb Musaga, in Ngikoto, was attacked by an unknown armed group, killing 8 people, including an 11-year-old child who was nearby the place. A local administrator explains.
They called me at 8:30 that they have killed people. That is painful. Is that even young people of 11 and 13 years old, they were shot. Until now, things which I see in Musaga is not political. It's just these criminals. Another thing is that now, if you have a disagreement with a neighbor, he can hire someone to kill you. What I can say is that killings are taking place. Armed robbery is also there. And they use guns to steal. Very bad. That some civilians are illegally armed.
According to the resident in Ngikoto, the armed group who carried out the attack targeted ruling party members who they believe to have been in the club.
Those who were killed live in Ngikoto, I don't know why they were killed. They were in a nightclub, and that's where they were attacked. These were people not involved any political issues. One was working in the battery, and another one was an architect. These are just criminals because now they are armed. They will only steal or kill people. What I can advise residents Musaga is to be united so as to report all these criminals to the police so that peace and stability could be restored.
Attacks and counterattacks have continued in Bujumbura as another nightclub in Bubanza was attacked by 3 grenades, leaving one young boy killed and 12 people injured, according to Vincent Ngendakumana, a local administrator.
It was at 7:50 p.m. when we heard the explosions at the local pub of Menari, Nizigama. They threw 3 grenades consecutively and killed one young boy who was selling eggs and other 12 people who got injured. Here in Bubanza, normally the security situation is good. However, it is not the first time this pub has been attacked. The few days, a grenade exploded in the same bar but caused no damage. These are criminals who want to threaten people from stopping over for a drink.
Chibitoki and Mutakura, located in Bujumbura, have been the hotspots of protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza since last April. The suburbs have seen increased insecurity as armed groups attack the security forces during the night patrols.
We always conduct security meetings in order to restore stability in our area. Most importantly, we should do investigation, most especially those who are new in the areas, so they can register themselves so as to know who is who.
as Burundi government promised to investigate on the ongoing attacks on civilians in the capital. An old man was found beheaded on Monday morning, laying in the street of Bujumbura. However, the security officials says that they have launched investigation in the matter. I'm Moses Havyarimana for VOA Africa in Bujumbura.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. With Yehaya Swuhib, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. A human rights group is calling on Egypt's president to condemn comments by his justice minister. The comments appear to advocate the mass killing of Muslim Brotherhood supporters. In a letter to President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, Human Rights Watch says the president should make clear he does not endorse Justice Minister Ahmed al-Zin's remarks that he would not be satisfied until 10,000 Brotherhood members were killed for every slain member of the armed forces. Al-Zin made the remarks on January 28th on satellite channel Sada al-Balad. The rights group says the interview was widely shared on social media. Human Rights Watch says President el-Sisi should clarify that his government will prosecute anyone who commits, orders, or assists in murder or other crimes against Brotherhood supporters or any other group because of their political or ideological affiliation.
There have been continuing calls from the supporters of Paul Biya, the 83-year-old president of Cameroon who has been in power for more than three decades, to stand again as candidate for president. The calls, which opposition parties are strongly condemning, are also asking Biya to call early presidential elections. The president's opponents say each time Biya wants to organize elections, he orders his supporters to invite him to run, to give an impression he is loved by the people. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has the story.
Thousands of people have been transported to the town of Monatele near Cameroon's capital Yaoundé by government ministers, influential businessmen and politicians of the ruling political party, the Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, CPDM. Henri Eyebe Ayisi, Cameroon's Minister of Agriculture, says they have assembled the people to publicly show their support to Cameroon President Paul Biya.
We are appealing the head of state to organize a presidential election this year, 2016. And it needs that he use the constitutional powers he had to modify the constitution so that he could organize this anticipated election.
Professor Jacques Famdongo, a spokesperson for Biya's party, says he is pleasantly surprised at the spontaneity of the calls.
Il s'agit d'une action qui émane de la base, et la base n'est pas manipulée.
He says it is an initiative of grassroots Cameroonians, and no one has been manipulated to ask Biya to be a candidate. He says the people want the man who has guaranteed the social, cultural and economic development of Cameroon to be a candidate for president again. He says the hierarchy of his party has not influenced anyone to make declarations supporting Biya's candidacy. Mfongwa Stanley, who says he is a grassroots supporter of Biya's party, disagrees and says opinions were not sought from people like him.
The People's Court does not really imply that they are the people talking. There are just some greedy Cameroonians around who just want to make their voice to be heard, to adhere to their position. So that makes no sense to me. If you go back to the organigram of the CPDM party, you realize that nobody can stand an election with him. He wants to remain in power.
Nancy Elvis, youth president for the opposition National Union for Democracy and Progress, says he is convinced Biya initiated the calls for his re-election himself.
It would have been a CPDM call, not the people's call. It's a psychological game they are playing. But I think it's very unnecessary because all of us are sensitive about the fact that, you know, it's not just about his willingness to be in power. It's also about the performance, his age and everything. There's need for change. And Cameroonians are thirsty for that change.
Paul Biya was prime minister from 1975 to 1982 when he became president following the resignation of the Central African States First leader, Ahmadou Ahidjo. In 2008, he revised the 1996 constitution and eliminated presidential term limits. Biya is in his fifth year of his current seven-year term. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization says thousands of African children lack textbooks or must share them. A new UNESCO report says that along with skilled teachers, textbooks are essential for meeting the UN-backed Sustainable Development Goals. The goals call for inclusive and equitable quality education for all. From Washington, VOA's William Eagle reports.
The Global Educational Monitoring Report policy paper, published by UNESCO, discusses the extent of the shortages and proposes solutions. It says that in Cameroon, one study showed there were 12 students for one reading book and 14 to a math book. In some parts of Uganda, there were up to 30 pupils per textbook. Asma Zuberi, a researcher for the report, says shortages can be particularly acute according to primary grade level and location of the school.
Provision of books in the earlier grades, which in some cases should be paramount, because this is where the largest impact on learning can take place, is where many children are actually without access to textbooks. And similarly, where schools are in remote or rural areas, this is where most children who are going to schools in these areas actually face the largest book shortages.
The World Bank recommends between 3-5% of a country's education budget be spent on textbooks. But the report found that in reality, a very small amount is earmarked for such purchases. In fact, UNESCO says that in some countries like Burundi and the Central African Republic, that figure is only 1%. Other problems contribute to the shortages. Money promised to schools for books and materials in the approved budget may arrive late or be diverted for other uses. Some African officials try to save money by purchasing books with poor quality paper and binding.
In Ethiopia, this is a very good example where secondary school textbooks were being printed on poor quality paper and with poor binding, although they were being produced quite cheaply. But what this inevitably meant is that textbooks were having to be replaced much more frequently. And this coupled with the fact that there was quite poor distribution and storage meant that many children were being left without books.
Remedies for the shortages include increasing share of education budgets spent on textbooks and also improving transparency. Zuberi says Africa could make use of a model created in the Philippines, where at one point 40% of book deliveries were not accounted for. The problem was solved with improved monitoring and transparency, thanks to the cooperation between civil society groups and the Ministry of Education. Zuberi says commercial distribution systems can also become more efficient. She says that books used to cost 50% more in Kenya than in neighboring Rwanda. The difference was that in Rwanda, publishers delivered textbooks directly to the schools, whereas Kenya used booksellers acting as middlemen.
So the number of people it's actually having to go through as far as distribution is concerned is a lot more, and that actually adds to the cost. So trying to cut through the numbers of actors involved in delivering to schools could be one way through which the cost of distribution could actually be lowered.
The UNESCO report also says funding can be made more available and costs could be contained, with improved forecasting for the number of books needed over a multi-year period. She says it's a model used successfully by the International Vaccine Alliance called Gavi.
As the health sector has demonstrated through the use of demand forecasting for vaccines, what you found there is that not only does it lead to more predictable funding, but it also reduces quite a lot of the wastage, which is something that the textbook sector should try and emulate to ensure that there's not a shortage or a surplus of stock, which can actually lead to increased costs in terms of the price of textbooks.
Zuberi says a proposed global book fund could help estimate Africa's book needs over the medium term. It would encourage donors to pool resources and make bulk purchases of textbooks. UNESCO hopes the plan will help attract and allocate funding and resources similar to the model used for ensuring the international availability of vaccines. Officials say if the model works as well in the education sector as it does in the health sector, the plan could attract sustainable funding over a multi-year period and encourage private investors to take part in the book market. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Reuters reports more than 20 migrants and refugees drowned today when their boats sank off the Turkish coast while trying to reach Greece. The figure is expected to rise because 13 others are missing. Four were rescued. Greece announced today it would have migrant reception centers operating by next week. Greece has been under pressure by other EU states to do more to control the flow of new arrivals. They have threatened to exclude Greece from the Schengen zone, which allows passport-free travel. More than 1 million migrants and refugees traveled to Europe last year. The vast majority arrived through Greece. Reuters also reports some residents on the Greek island of Kos scuffled with police as they protested construction of a reception center. Analysts say Greece is ill-prepared to handle the refugee flow because of its recent economic crisis.
The Obama administration is asking Congress for nearly $2 billion in emergency funding to deal with the threat of the Zika virus. The White House says the funds would enhance ongoing efforts to prepare both domestically and internationally. The Pan American Health Organization reports local Zika transmission in 26 countries and territories in the Americas. So far, mosquito transmission of the virus has not been reported within the continental U.S., Puerto Rico, and other U.S. territories in warmer areas. However, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that could quickly change in the warmer months ahead. Meanwhile, in Europe, the French news agency reports a team of experts is being assembled to develop drugs and vaccines against Zika. While symptoms are fairly mild for most people infected, that's fear it's responsible for birth defects in thousands of infants.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Ihis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more. Coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa.
will focus on the rising concerns over the global spread of the Zika virus. Join me, Esther Githui-Ewart, as guest host and health experts as we discuss the Zika virus. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. It's estimated 4.7 million people, or about 40% of the Somali population, are in need of humanitarian assistance. Killings continue in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, despite security forces carrying out disarmament operations. And tens of thousands of civilians have been displaced by fighting in Sudan's Darfur region. Coming up, we'll have music from Burkina Faso. And in our feature segment, Uganda prepares for national elections this month. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young, and happy Super Monday, Sunny.
I like that. Happy Super Monday, Kim.
And Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for the new Super Bowl champions.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the Denver Broncos, who defeated the Carolina Panthers 24-10 to win the Super Bowl of American-style professional football in Santa Clara, California. VOA's Park Brewer filed this post-game report from Santa Clara.
Denver relied on its number one-ranked defense to stifle the high-powered offense of Carolina and its star quarterback, Cam Newton, who a day before had won the NFL's Most Valuable Player Award. But it was Newton's four turnovers, thanks to the Broncos' defense, that proved costly to his Panthers. Denver intercepted two of his passes and forced him to fumble twice with hard hits. Newton's first fumble deep in his own territory in the first quarter resulted in a Denver touchdown. His second came late in the game with the Broncos leading 16-10 and gave them the ball near the Panthers' goal line. Denver scored shortly thereafter to seal the victory. It was the rare Super Bowl where an offensive player did not win the Most Valuable Player Award. That honor went to Denver linebacker Von Miller, who forced one of the fumbles.
It's honestly not about me. I mean, if I could cut this award up and give it to DeMarcus Wilson, all the other guys, that's what I would do. This is our greatest stuff. But for me, you know, I want to be with my guys. I would take the ring. You know, MVP is great, but I take the ring. I want to go in there with my teammates.
Winning his second Super Bowl ring was Peyton Manning, who at age 39 is the oldest quarterback to win the big game.
Up until that final second goes off, you're kind of into the game and into the moment. But I was certainly very excited, and it's a special moment to be there with your teammates and, you know, see Coach Kubiak get the Gatorade poured on him and, you know, have a chance to visit with, you know, coaches and players. That is a unique moment because after that, it's a little bit chaotic. Everybody's kind of going separate places, getting pulled on, and that moment on the sidelines is always something that you'll remember.
He also became the first to quarterback different teams to the championship. He won with the Indianapolis Colts in 2007. Park Brewer, VOA News, Santa Clara, California.
Thanks, Park. As Park mentioned, 39-year-old Peyton Manning is the oldest quarterback to win the Super Bowl. Manning will celebrate his 40th birthday next month, and some think this 50th Super Bowl might have been the final game of his great National Football League career. At the post-game news conference, Manning declined to say whether he'll now retire.
Everybody has an analysis of that. I'm going to kind of follow old coach's advice, and I think I'll make a good decision. I think I'll be at peace with it, whichever way it goes. But like I said, I'm looking forward to tonight being with my family and my friends and some teammates and celebrating this special victory and this special win.
This special victory and special win was Denver's third Super Bowl title. The Broncos won back-to-back Super Bowls in 1997 and 1998 when John Elway was the team's star quarterback. Elway is now Denver's general manager, and in his words, Peyton Manning doesn't need to worry or think about retirement now. He's worked too hard to get to where he is now. He has plenty of time in the offseason to reminisce and look back.
The Voice of America, VOA.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Here's another Sunny Side of Sports salute to the Leopards of the Democratic Republic of Congo, who defeated Mali 3-0 to win the African Nations Championship football tournament in Kigali, Rwanda. Our VOA football fans will remember this three-week tournament was for home-based players in Africa who compete in their respective national leagues. Marco Uma tells us more about the triumph by the Congolese.
A brace scored by Meshack Elia and one by Jonathan Bolingi propelled the Democratic Republic of Congo to a convincing 3-0 victory over Mali in the Orange African Nations Championship final in Kigali, Rwanda on Sunday. Earlier on, Ivory Coast edged Guinea 2-1 to clinch the bronze medal. This is the second time the Congolese have lifted the trophy, having triumphed at the inaugural edition in Ivory Coast in 2009. Staying in Kigali, the Confederation of African Football First Vice President Suketu Patel disclosed that CAF is backing Bahrain's Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa in the forthcoming FIFA presidential elections.
What I'd like to say is, in accordance with the item on the CAF executive agenda, the executive committee decided today that CAF will give full support to Sheikh Salman bin Khalifa towards his candidacy for FIFA presidency.
It is now left to each of CAF's 54 national affiliates, the largest voting bloc in FIFA, to cast their secret ballot at the elections in Zurich, Switzerland, on the 26th of February.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show, which you can hear Monday through Friday on The Voice of America. Just ahead on the Sunny Side of Sports, our Daybreak Africa host, James Buddy, will have a sporty Black History Month segment for us.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month fact for today, February 8th. On this day in 1986, figure skater Debbie Thomas became the first African-American to win the women's singles of the U.S. National Figure Skating Championship competition. She went on to win a bronze medal in the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary, Canada, before retiring from amateur figure skating. Also on this day in 1978, Leon Spinks defeated world heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali. Ali regained the title on September 15 that same year and went on to become the first person to win the heavyweight boxing title three times.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
The Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Once again, those addresses, facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle, @VOA Sunny Sports. Some of my Facebook friends are checking in after the Democratic Republic of Congo won its second African Nations Championship football trophy. Antoine Kamwenyi, who lives in the DR Congo's capital, Kinshasa, writes, "Sonny, it's a feast here in my country. We get the trophy for a second time. And yes," says Antoine, "I like that sporty look." I liked your Facebook comments, Antoine. Thanks for writing, bro. Ikechukwu Nwachukwu, writing from Enugu, Nigeria, says, "Congrats to the Congolese." And Ike adds, "I love this tournament more than the Africa Cup of Nations. I know some people confuse the two tournaments, so I'll repeat once again, in the Africa Cup of Nations, African players who are based in Europe and overseas are allowed to compete, but in the African Nations Championship, or CHAN, only home-based African players who compete in their national leagues are eligible." Kamara BMJ, writing from Lusaka, Zambia, says, "Well done, neighbor." And Kamara adds, "I support TP Mazembe, the Congolese club based in Lubumbashi in the Democratic Republic of Congo." Felix Ukwe, writing from Wari, Nigeria, says, "Congrats to the DRC." While Nacha Zarma, who lives in Kaduna, Nigeria, says it was a superb performance by the Leopards of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Jonas Chishimba sent me another Facebook comment from Lusaka, Zambia. Jonas says, "The Congolese boys deserve that trophy. They display seriousness and hard work from the start of the tournament. Congrats and keep up the good work." Thanks for writing from Lusaka, Jonas. Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us now from Johannesburg with his latest quiz question.
Which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League? And that includes the former name of the competition. It was then known as the African Cup of Champions Clubs. So what we're talking about, Sonny, is way back to 1964 when this competition started. So it's between 1964 and 2015. Which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League?
2016 is a leap year, David, so we're going to set a deadline of Monday, February 29th, to get your entries in. David and I will now tell you where you can send your entries.
VOA!
It's david.legg, and Legg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.legg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. And the first three people with correct answers to David Legg's African football quiz will be receiving some of those delightful VOA goodies. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, Uganda
preparing for
Coming up, Uganda preparing for national elections this month. And next, providing clean energy to more than 300,000 homes across East Africa. But first, some music. Here is Ja Verite from Burkina Faso with Bekasso. Verite from Burkina Faso with Bekasso.
As Uganda prepares for national elections February 18th, the country's youth are split over the decision to exercise their right to vote. The growing number of young eligible voters could hold considerable sway in the balloting, yet many feel ignored by candidates. Elizabeth Pala has more from Kampala.
Uganda is one of the youngest countries in the world, with 78% of the population below the age of 30. Yet when it comes to voting in the upcoming presidential elections, many youths are opting out. It's not a disinterest in politics, but rather a feeling expressed by many that their involvement lacks impact. Shaban Kalema is the chairman of the Interparty Youth Platform, which helped establish a national youth manifesto. It identified five main issues important to Uganda's youth, including jobs, healthcare, education opportunities, sports and creative arts, and youth participation in decision-making. Kalema says he will absolutely vote, but acknowledges their manifesto has been largely ignored by candidates.
Because now, if these candidates that are seeking political offices, if their manifestos have not identified with our demands, so tomorrow I may sit down and say, now, why should I even vote? So partly it has contributed to a voter apathy because they have failed to attract youth with the programs they have.
Many also feel they could face danger going to the polls. A recent report by Human Rights Watch says frequent use of tear gas and police brutality could undermine free and fair elections. Vote rigging is also a concern. Moses Agunyu, an assistant project officer with the International Republican Institute, says many youth who grew up under Yoweri Museveni's presidency see voting as pointless.
Someone would think, well, but what difference will it make? Why would I even go and vote? If every election that comes, we vote people who say we will fight poverty, we will deal with corruption, we will deal with unemployment, but we see unemployment increasing, we see corruption skyrocketing, we see poverty on the rise, people can't afford basic needs. So what's the point of elections? And of course, I think many Ugandans now feel that maybe it is even impossible to change leadership by just casting a vote. It's not happened in Uganda before.
Others, like young voter Rita Nkyanzi, feel Museveni's opposition, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi, and FDC candidate Kizza Besigye, cannot fix Uganda.
The fact is, there is still some times where I feel, even if I go and vote, what is going to change? I really look at a situation where, whether it is Amama or Besigye coming in, it may be just a change of person, but not necessarily change of practical leadership.
Uganda's national elections are scheduled for February 18th. According to the Electoral Commission, some 15 million Ugandans are registered to vote. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
In Kenya, a company called M-Kopa Solar is providing clean energy to more than 300,000 homes across East Africa by allowing customers to pay as you go via their cell phones. As Lenny Ruvaga reports from Kangima, customers pay a small deposit for a solar unit and then pay less than a dollar a day to get clean energy to light up their homes or businesses.
Gilbert Ondieki is installing a solar panel from M-Copper on the roof of his shop in Kangemi on the outskirts of Nairobi. He says having a steady supply of electricity has meant more sales, earning more cash for his family.
M-Copper Solar has really boosted my business because in the past, when darkness set in, I would close for the day. But now I'm able to work late into the night and close whenever I want to.
M-Copper, whose name comes from the Swahili word for borrow, sells the solar kits for $35, and customers then pay 50 cents a day for a year, after which they own their systems. The kit contains an 8-watt solar panel, two LED bulbs, a rechargeable flashlight, a phone charger, and a rechargeable radio. M-Copper users pay using their mobile phones, making it more efficient to track cost and use. Jesse Moore is M-Copper's CEO.
In 10 years, the rest of the world will look at what leapfrogging technologies came out of Kenya and came out of East Africa, and I think we will have a situation where this part of the world is the role model for others, going off the grid, harnessing the power of the sun, and connecting people affordably, reliably, and quickly in a way that's never been done before.
And business is booming.
Welcome to M-Copper. My name is Gloria. How may I assist you?
Gloria Lucidio is one of more than 200 M-Copper customer care representatives helping people across East Africa with their solar energy systems. M-Copper now has pay-as-you-go customers in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. It offers an alternative to traditional power companies, such as in Kenya, where only 4 million households are connected to the national electricity grid in a country of 42 million. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Kangemi, Kenya.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, Visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Alfredo Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria James Entwistle was present at the Memorandum of Understanding signing ceremony in Kaduna, Nigeria in late January for routine immunization in Borno, Kaduna, Sokoto, and Bauchi states. I am proud that the U.S. government is joining the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Dangote Foundation in the strong pursuit to end vaccine-preventable child deaths in Nigeria, said Ambassador Entwistle. Under this partnership, we are helping Sokoto State to increase and sustain high immunization coverage. This occasion demonstrates the willingness and commitment of your governments and organizations to tackle the challenges to achieving these goals. The United States provides significant resources, more than $500 million annually, for programs to address serious health issues, such as child mortality, maternal and newborn health, HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. These MOUs offer the model platform to capitalize on the prospects of evidence-based approaches, said Ambassador Entwistle. Results will include stronger systems for immunizations, equal access to routine immunization services, and building capacity for Nigerian states like Sokoto to lead in developing solutions for its people. Perhaps even more importantly, these agreements serve as a model on which to base future partnerships between development partners and the government of Nigeria. Ensuring transparency and accountability in the implementation of this program demonstrates the pledge of the governments of all the states involved to ensuring they meet their responsibilities to their constituents. Essential health services, like routine immunization programs, can only be provided when all partners are coordinated and committed in this manner. Immunization represents one of the most cost-effective public health interventions. Routine immunization services, when sustained, reduce maternal and child illnesses and deaths and free up other resources for economic development. Under this partnership, the U.S. government will maintain its focus on Sokoto State, offering quality technical assistance in support of the partners' harmonized work plan in that state. Our ultimate goal, said Ambassador Entwistle, is to end preventable child and maternal deaths and to achieve an AIDS-free generation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tuesday on Health Chat. Host Lenore Modou continues her discussions about Zika virus with her guest, Dr. Oluwatosi Omele, Family and Community Medicine, Howard University Hospital. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We'll call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat is Tuesday at 1730 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll focus on the rising concerns over the global spread of the Zika virus join me, Esther Githui-Ewart, as guest host and health experts as we discuss the Zika virus. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.